want to thank Rabbi Gersten very much for taking the time out of his schedule to be able to share with us. Rabbi Gersten is a unique expert in the field of kashrus. He is the person that's in the room with the OU Poskim when they are dealing with the most complex kashrus issues. He often tracks down the sources of them, talks through the issues with them, and anyone that you ask in the kashrus industry, if you have a major question, they always say the first person you have to speak to is Rabbi Gersten, and we're so grateful for him for taking time to give us a short shiur followed by a question answer session. Thank you so much, Rabbi Gersten.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Rabbi Leibowitz. B'shus, kol kodesh hazeh. So the topic I wanted to speak about is it's probably one that you probably have not dealt with, and certainly it doesn't really appear in Shulchan Aruch. It's the topic of extended Irui, and I'll explain. It actually comes up very much so in Kashrus. And what exactly is the status of this? Where does it fit into the rules? We know you have different levels of Kalim. You have a Kli Rishon Al Eish, you have a Kli Rishon that's not Al Eish, you have a Irui Kli Rishon, you have a Kli Sheini, you have a Kli Shlishi, Irui Kli Sheini, all different levels. And we know the rule, the fundamental rule of kashering is Kabbalah Kachpaltai. You have to assess how the Kli was used, and you have to kasher it at least at that level, if not better. Those that say L'chatchila, you should always kasher every Kli Ala Eish, Kli Rishon Ala Eish, even if it was only Balei as a Kli Sheini. Those that say like that, that L'chatchila. Okay, but we know B'mikra Din, you could kasher Kabbalah Kachpaltai. One of the problems that comes up in kashers is oftentimes, you know, you're dealing with a little spoon, so it's very easy. I can find myself a pot, and I can boil up the water, and I can drop it in, I can make sure that it's al eish. In factories, you have very, very large kalim. You can't move them. They're in place. And you have to figure out a way. Sometimes the kli doesn't get all that hot. Maybe it gets up to, you know, it has to, we'll talk about different ways it's heated, but whatever reason, it doesn't get all that hot, it doesn't get boiling. You have to come up with, you certainly can't pick it up and move it and drop it into a pot of boiling water. So you're limited in how you're going to, what you can do to kasher it. The idea, let me first introduce the idea of the extended Irui, then we'll bring some applications of it, and then we'll maybe try to get to the rayas of whether this works or not. The application of it is that most companies will have something called a spray ball. Okay, a spray ball is a pipe hooked up to a ball, and it looks like a shower head, sort of. It'll have more holes in all directions, though, than a shower, so it's not only facing downward, it could be facing in all directions. Some of them rotate, some of them are fixed. Either way, they have a boiler elsewhere where they boil up water, and then they'll send the water, they'll pump the water through the spray ball, and it'll basically give a shower to the kettle, to the container, whatever it is, the holding tank, whatever it is that you're trying to clean. This is how the companies themselves clean. And then they can put all different things through that pipe, through that ball. They can put through soap, water, they can put through, usually consists of a caustic mixed into the water. They could do plain water, they could do cold water. So the different ways that they can, and it's very high pressure. So meaning the water will come shooting out of it, you know, very, very high pressure, and it'll, so be very, very hot, very high pressure, and it'll clean very well. And that's basically the method that companies use. And the question is this adequate for kashering a kettle? Let's say the kettle is a steam kettle. Does it have to be filled back up with water, turn on the steam, bring it to a boil, boil it over that way? Sometimes that's not possible to do. Or is it maybe some combination? Maybe some of it, maybe you put the steam on, but then have the spray ball going. Maybe you can't have the do going at the same time. I'll give another application of it. You have something called a spray dryer, which is a very, very large piece of machinery, usually several stories tall. It has a huge chamber inside of it, and then it is hot air is blown into it. Very hot air, about 400 degrees or so. It's like an oven. Hot air is blown in, and at the same time, a mist is blown into it on the other side, and the hot air will dissolve, will evaporate the mist, and the mist will turn into a powder because there's little, you know, things in that mist, and it'll drop down to the bottom, and they collect it. They call that a spray dryer. And how do you kosher it? You can't fill it with water. This thing is too huge. It would be too heavy. It would topple over if you tried filling it with water. It doesn't hold water. It's like an oven, so to speak. You know, so it's a different, separate question whether it even can be kashered with Hagala. But assuming it could, let's assume that the proper way to kasher this would be with Hagala. How do you do Hagala on this? Okay, you can't fill it with water, so you have to do the method that's used is they use spray balls. They will have them at all different locations inside the machine. Sometimes they'll preheat it if possible. Sometimes even if you preheat it by turning on the heat, they can't leave the heat on while the spray ball is going at the same time. Sometimes they could do is they could preheat it, but then they have to make adjustments inside to attach the spray ball. By the time they're finished, the machine is you know, warm at best. And then they, you know, then they do the spray balls. At least it's not cold walls, but maybe it's, you know, maybe it's 120 degrees or something in the wall by the time they finish with this whole process of resetting it up for the spray ball. All types of cases in factories. And the question is, is it help if I spray boiling water at a kli long enough? Could that be considered like a hagala? Okay. So I don't know if everyone got the page that I handed out, that I sent out. If people have a chance to print it, if not, they could just listen. You know, it's not just things that probably people are mostly basically familiar with. Just just give some armakomas for them. Shulchan Aruch writes in Siman Tzadik Beis, right? It many places this is written, but there's one place is Ein Yiruy Oyser Rak Kedei Klipa. We know that Yiruy is only Kedei Klipa. So in theory, right, you shouldn't be able to kasher the whole thickness of a wall. Even if you're going to say that Yiruy is Mevashel, which that itself is a Shiloh, it's Safik Mevashel, you pass it. But even if you say it is Mevashel, it's only Mevashel Kedei Klipa. So how could I kasher the entire thickness of a kettle, which needs kashering, with just an Yiruy? Now, there's a concept brought, and this is whenever the concept of extended Yiruy comes up, people confuse it with this Taz. I just want to get the Taz out of the way to say this is not what we're discussing here. The Taz in Siman Tzadik Beis, in Siman Tzadik Hei, mentions there's a concept by a talks about a teller. It's a type of a serving platter, and you do many Yiruyim onto it. You put hot meat onto it many times, and he said, the Issur Hetter brings a Chumra over here that because of the multiple Yiruyim, it's going to be absorbed more than a Kedei Klipa. The first time I do Yiruy onto it, it will absorb a Kedei Klipa. The second one will push that in another Kedei Klipa. Third, fourth, eventually I can asur the entire Kli. This says, therefore, if you put a Kli Sheni into, you cooked it up together with something that was a Kli Sheni, something with a Kli Rishon, say one was Milchigs, one was Fleishigs, you don't say, well, up the Evid, it won't asur because it was only a Kedei Klipa. You say, no, through the multiple Yiruyim, it will asur the Kulai. Okay? It's right, it's a shiloh whether anyone paskas like this Issur Hetter, or maybe they do only l'chumra. Certainly not to use this idea l'kula that I have multiple iruyim. I could then say that it's mevashel b'kulai. Okay, so that's not what we're talking about. We're going to differentiate between multiple iruyim and an extended iruy. Okay, so multiple iruyim means I do one iruy and then 2 minutes later I do another iruy and 2 minutes later, right? The extended iruy we're talking about over here is going to be, right, it's continuous and it's going to heat up the kli itself. So instead of just being, you know, cooling back down and then getting another Yiruy, it won't have any time to cool down in between. It'll go from one Yiruy straight into the next. Now, the I guess one of the places to start, the famous Taisus and Shabbos, that defines what is the difference between a Kli Rishon and a Kli Sheni. Right? We know the Kli Rishon is Mevashel, right? The Kli Sheni is not. And they fundamentally, you know, they look pretty similar. They're both pots with hot water inside of them. And yet we say, if this is a Kli Rishon, it can be Mevashel. If this is a Kli Sheni, it can't be Mevashel. If I put my finger into it, I won't be able to tell whether it's a Kli Rishon or a Kli Sheni. I'll get burnt either way. So what's the fundamental difference? So Taisus explains over there in Shabbos, right? He asks this question, Tema, Maishna Kli Sheni mi Kli Rishon. What is the difference? If it's Yatzaledes, I feel a Kli Sheni nami. If it ain't Yatzaledes, I feel a Kli Rishon nami and Mevashel. So Marushach, if it's Yatzaledes, what's the difference? Why aren't they both cooking? The difference is that the Kli Rishon was on the fire, and therefore its walls are hot. And therefore it maintains the heat for a long time. And therefore we have this rule that so long as it's Yatzaledes, it can still cook because it maintains its heat. But a Kli Sheni, by its mutter, she'ein darf naisav chamim, halachu miskar, it cools down fast. So that's what Tais says. That's the fundamental chalak between a Kli Rishon and a Kli Sheni. One maintains its heat, one loses its heat quickly. Okay, so using this idea, right, so we could suggest that if I have a Kli that does not lose its heat because I'm continuously doing an Irui on it, I'm constantly reheating it, the water is draining out and I'm constantly pouring more water into it so that it'll stay at an equilibrium, it's not cooling down, then perhaps that would be a Kli Rishon. On the other hand, Taisa says that this Kli, because it was Oymed Ala Or, maybe that's some sort of a Mitoksha Oymed Ala Or, Dafnas Achamen. Maybe the Milo of a Kli Rishon is Dafka, that it was Dafnas of, that it was Oymed Ala Or. So we have, right, we can have Diyukim Lakan Ulakan, based on this Taisus. There's a Chavis Das. Before I get to Chavis Das, let me just introduce the Taz, because that's really what it's based on. The question is, when you're dealing with a ladle, and this is a question that comes up for Shabbos too, what is the status of a ladle? Is a ladle have the din of a Kli Rishon or a Kli Sheni? So by Shabbos, we know I'm not supposed to leave the ladle in too long. It could be considered like a Kli Rishon then, and then when I pour my soup from the ladle into the bowl, maybe the bowl will only be a Kli Sheni. If you want the bowl to be a Kli Shlishi, because then it makes enough kamina if you can put challah into your soup and things like that. So you want to do it quickly so that the ladle don't leave the ladle in the pot of soup till it gets too hot. Okay, especially if it's on the fire. Okay, Hagasa questions, we'll ask whatever, deal with different time, why, whatever. But anyway, so that's the fundamental rule over here, is that if it stays in the pot, it can become a Kli Rishon. If it's taken out of the pot quickly, then the ladle will be viewed as a Kli Sheni. So the Taz is basically dealing with this question about, you know, does it really become a Kli Rishon if I leave it in the pot too long? He brings a Maril that says, yes, if you leave it in the pot, it'll become a Kli Rishon. At the end of the Taz, he brings a Taisus that seems to say not that way, that it won't become a Kli Rishon even then. And he leaves it as he says, that maybe it's not a Kli Rishon. He brings the Taisus himself as Mistapik on this din. Not clear. That's the Taz's take on it. Okay, before we get to Chavis Das, let's skip to the Mishnah Berurah for a second. The Mishnah Berurah writes, he's talking about kashering for Pesach. So can I use a ladle to kasher? Something needs irui. So it's easier for me to boil up a big pot of water. I'll put my ladle in. I'll draw out some water, and I'll use that ladle to pour over the thing that needs irui. Okay, I want to kasher my sink, for instance. So can I just put my ladle in, pull out some water, and I'll bring it over to my sink? Instead of bringing a whole big pot of water, it's going to get dangerous maybe to pour a whole big pot around my sink. It's much easier if I take a ladle and I'll go with the ladle around my sink. Is that acceptable? Okay. So the Mishnah Berurah writes that when you're kashering, you should be careful to kasher from the kli itself, from the kettle itself. Don't use a ladle. Okay, okay, if I use a ladle, that would be called a Kli Sheni. Unless I use an Evan Malubin when I kasher, a heated stone, and then that would make it back to being a Kli Rishon again. Okay, Magen Avraham b'shem the Maril. So the Mishnah Berurah ends up paskening over here, Lakula, that if you do leave it in long enough, whatever the amount of time is, you have to leave it in there until it bubbles up inside the ladle. But once you do that, then Echanami, that would make the ladle into a Kli Rishon, and then you'd be able to use that to kasher your sink. Okay? So that's the Mishnah Berurah's Hachra, is like the Maril. Not like the end of the Taz, who says that it's a Suffolk. The Mishnah Berurah himself is actually what we would call in this context over here is Makel, that it is a Kli Rishon. It would be a Chumrah Lagabe Shabbos, right, that if you do that, but it would be a Kula for Hagala. Now the Chavis Das takes a middle of the road approach over here, and he says, he asks this question, it's here in the Diyukim and Taisus. He points out this is really, right, you can make the Diyukim and Taisus both ways. Okay, Luchaira Hadiyukim Shebetaisus Sasri Adadi. He says the Diyuk and Taisus contradict themselves. First, he says it works because it was heated on the fire. That's what makes it into a kli rishon. Mashma the davar she'ein lo defanes hamachamos, af she'ein lo gam ki defanes mekayreis. If you have something that the walls aren't heated, but the walls aren't being cooled either, okay, we'll see his example of what this is. But it doesn't have heated walls, but it doesn't have cooling walls either. So it's not a kli rishon. It's not a kli she'ini. So which one is the kaveh over here? Then maybe it's not mevashel. It's mevashel because it was not on the fire. Maybe the kaveh will make something into a kli rishon was it had to be on a fire. The davar gush ain't a mevashel mitam she ain't lo defanes mechamais af shekau ki ain't lo defanes mekarais. That example that would be perhaps a davar gush. A davar gush, it doesn't have defanes mekarais, okay, but yet it doesn't have defanes mechamais anymore either. It's out of the pot. So such a thing is no longer. That's what the mechaz yakov writes. It's not mevashel. The gabi klisheini. But yet the other way he says what makes it into a cliche, Taisa said, is because it doesn't have defanes and mekayreis. Because it does have defanes mekayreis. Mashma koshein le defanes mekayreis. It is mevashel. So which is the kaveh over here? Is it that it doesn't have? It's not in a cool setting. It's not in a cliche, which is cooling it down. Or does it have to be that it was on the fire and it has defanes mekayreis? So the Chavis Das, he's pushing it like this. He says it both ways. It's in the middle. He's to give the following example. You're going to kli shaitziu imayim kashu tatata. If you take a ladle out of the pot, that water which is still in that ladle will be mevashel so long as it is the tata. The tata means it is the bottom surface and something else is being placed into the ladle. Okay, but davar acher nitin l'taychay. So if I took a ladle ladle full of soup or full of hot water out of the pot, and let's say that would have a din of a kli rishon to it. Gabi Shabbos, anything that you can't put into a kli rishon, you wouldn't be allowed to put into that ladle. That ladle would be a kli rishon. It would be mevashel. So, or certainly, right, if you put raw foods in, it could be mevashel. It's a kli rishon. Kivin delay niskar b'shum pam. Nothing cooled it down. It was on the fire. It was a kli rishon. It will maintain a kli rishon. But mashenkin, if I pour from this ladle now onto cold foods, then it can't cook. Why? It will be a din of kedin shar iroi shenifse kakiloch. This will now have the status of what's known as iroi shenifse kakiloch. Even though it's not nifse kakiloch from the ladle, but it's nifse kakiloch from the pot. Yeah, it's not connected anymore to those defanes mechamamais. So he says, when it's in the ladle, it still have a din of a kli rishon. If I pour from there, even though it's not nifsek hakiluach from the ladle, it'll have the status of a nifsek hakiluach anyways. Okay, v'had yirushal, and the chilek between nifsek hakiluach or not, is whether it's just a chumrah or whether it's really mevash. Even though we're machmer, even by that it's mevashal k'nei klipa, even where it's nifsek hakiluach, it's just a chumrah. But the Magen Avraham brings that the nifsek hakiluach is not a real, it's not really mevashal, it's just a chumrah, as opposed to from a kli rishon. There, it's actually mevashel. So he says, "V'had the yirushal nisak kiluach mevashel k'day klipa hu mitam shakiluach mekusher b'tefanei shehoch b'bor." It has to be connected back to the fire, to the pot that was heated on the fire. Abo kasheim lo shum kishurim daifin shochem b'or ba'adei dein mevashel kol. Then it's not mevashel at all. Okay, so we have the Chavis Das's pshara. Okay, that he says, well, if it's connected back to a kli rishon that was on the fire, then that irui is a real irui. If it's only connected back to the ladle, then it's not, that doesn't have the status of a real irui. The Lamaisa Pashas, we don't paskin like this Chavis Das, we paskin like the Mishnah Berurah, presumably, like the Magen Avraham, like the Maril, that even the ladle is a good kashering, and it is considered it is considered that it's mekosher back to the kli rishon. The ladle is a full kli rishon. It was cooked in the pot. It doesn't matter if the fire ever touched it or not. It's not right. The ladle that was sat in the pot has a din of a kli rishon too, even once it's removed. And if I do irui from there too, it's also considered an irui. Okay, this is really a hakdama to what we're going to discuss. I just give you some of the background ideas. So we have over here that a kli rishon, to be a kli rishon, it doesn't even have to have been on the fire. It was submerged in a kli rishon that was on the fire. That also gives it the status of a kli rishon. And its irui would have the same status as an irui from a Kli Rishon as well. Now, when we have a situation such as we described before, where I have a continuous Eroi and the Kli is not cooling down, okay? So on the one hand, you could say, well, still, it's just a Eroi. Eroi is only a Kedei Klipa, and if I have multiple, the same Kedei Klipa over and over, it's just being Mevashel, that same Kedei Klipa. Mechadesa, I'm kashering the whole thickness of the Kli. On the other hand, you could say, well, look, let's look at how it would fit into that Tosis. If I have a Kli that's not cooling down, it's not Poiches V'Hoilich, so if it's not Poiches V'Hoilich, that's a Kli Rishon. Okay, so maybe I should say over here, if I have extended Eroi on this Kli, let's say for 20 minutes or half an hour, I'm going to be showering this Kli with boiling water, such that the Kli will get heated and will maintain that heat and will not cool down. Maybe that too is considered a Kli Rishon. Now the truth is, just to put this into perspective, every kettle in a factory really works on this principle, because kettles in factories don't have fires underneath them. There's no gas fire that's underneath the kettle. The way it works is you have a boiler that heats up either hot water, brings up boiling water or steam, and the steam enters into the jacket of the kettle and it flows through it, and then it goes back around to the boiler again. So it makes a circuit, and the water is being pumped through this jacket, and therefore that's what cooks everything in the kettle. So if you were to make the argument that an extended Eroi only cooks the Kedei Klipa of the metal, then you'd have to then come to the conclusion that all the food inside this kettle is raw, right? Nothing ever is cooked in a factory, because even though it's all heated up, it's all heated up by a Eroi of boiling water, which is only heating the metal, the Kedei Klipa, which is the metal, and then everything else in the factory is never being cooked. And I once heard there was someone that said this, he was saying this as a svara why boilers never become treif, because boilers are only an Eroi, and Eroi is only a Kedei Klipa, and that's why. But it's a little bit ridiculous. I mean, the notion that nothing is mevushel, when I could cook anything. I could cook bisur datura, right, in these pots, because they are boiling water, and to say, well, nothing is getting cooked because it's only being cooked through an Eroi of hot water that enters the jacket, okay, and it flows through the jacket, and then it goes, makes a circuit around. Now, we're talking about these pots could be 100, 200 feet away from the boiler, but it's just pumped. Fast, high-speed pumps send the water there quickly. They don't lose all that much temperature along the way. And so, okay, that's one way. Even if you were to make such an argument, I mean, you could then argue the Kli doesn't need to be kashered at all, right? Nothing, it was never a Kli Rishon. It was just Eroi. It wasn't even a Kli Sheni. But even if you were to say, no, this Eroi is some sort of a Kli Rishon, okay, but not a full Kli Rishon. In truth is, that would be enough over here, because I'm kashering it then the same way that it was Balea. So I'd say, if it was Balea through an extended Eroi, I'm kashering it through an extended Eroi as well. So at the very least, in that case, right, in the case where it was the pot, the kettle was cooked with hot water or steam being pumped in from elsewhere, an Eroi from the boiler, if I were to kasher it with an extended Eroi of boiling water inside the kettle, it should do the same thing. Why does it matter if the boiling water is inside the jacket of the kettle, or if the boiling water is inside the where the food goes, the middle of the, not the jacket, the center of the kettle, right? You could argue it shouldn't make a difference. In either case, the kettle would be kashered. But the truth is, I want to show that it's not just because of Kibbolah Kachpolta, but really it is a Kli Rishon. That's really what I want to point out over here. There's a discussion in Shabbos. There's something called I guess today in modern Hebrew we call it a bathtub. Right, there's different types of kelim that they talk about in Hilchos Shabbos. There's a kli, there's a kais, I should say. There's a kais, there's a safal, and there's an abati. And they're different sizes, right? A kais is a cup, okay, maybe a large cup, whatever it is. It holds 10 ounces, 12, 16, 24 ounces, whatever a cup holds. There's a safal, which is some sort of a pitcher, holds a few multiples of that, whatever a safal holds. And then there's, I'm not sure exactly, some sort of a pail, we call it, maybe. Maybe it holds a few gallons even. And then there's something called an ambati. Ambati holds much more. I don't know how much, but you know, something that a person could place their whole body into. So maybe it holds 50 gallons, or who knows, whatever it is, a large amount. You know, I would envision something like our modern day bathtubs as an ambati. Now in halacha, there's a discussion. What is the ambati that the Gemara is referring to? Is it a kli rishon? Was there a fire under this ambati, or is it a kli sheni? The Gemara says you can't pour cold water into an ambati. So if this kli is a kli rishon, so partially you can't pour cold water in. You can't pour cold water into any kli rishon. So what's the chiddush? You can't pour it into an ambati. So Rishayim discussed this question. What exactly is this ambati over here? What makes it special that you can't pour it in? And is it a kli rishon? Is it a kli sheni? So I just want to point out, I saw something we've discussed many times with Rebelsky, Zatzal. He made, you know, these diukim. He thought they were doing it, but I saw other mafarshim, achrayim, I should say, also speak this out. I saw this diuk made. I didn't hear this part from Rebelsky. I didn't hear, but I saw others bring this as a diuk in the Rambam. The Rambam says, "Ambati shal merchutz, shehi malei mayim chamim, ein oisel lamayim tzayni, sherei mecham maharbe." Okay, so the Rambam says you can't pour cold water into an ambati. Shamerchatz, okay? It's used for ambati, it's used for washing, it's used for cleaning. You can't pour cold water into it. So they make the diak, shehi malaya mayim. Okay, so why is it Rambam have to say it's full of water? Let's say it wasn't full. Let's say it was half full. Let's say it was only a third full. Well, why is it important that the merchatz be malei mayim, that it was full of water? So they say, well, this is the part I heard from Balski. If you have a large, if I have when I'm dealing with a large kli, let's say I was to boil up, like they do in factories, they boil up 500 gallons of water. Okay, they have a large kettle, they boil up 500 gallons of water, and then they transfer this water, let's say, into a second tank. Let's say the first tank is where they boil the water, then they transfer it into a tank where they're going to mixer. Okay, they're going to transfer this 500 gallons of water, and then they're going to start mixing sugar and other things into it. But it's 500 gallons, so they're going to put it, so whatever it is, they're putting into the mixer. How do we deal with this second kli? So on the one hand, you could say, well, it's a klisheni. It's the only klisheni because the gelatin, whatever it is that was added in, it's only added into a klisheni. Maybe it doesn't really answer the keli. It's not such a problem. So the svarafakar is to say no. By an ambati, it has the din of a kli rishon, even if it's a klisheni, because of its large size. Like we mentioned before, Taisa said, "What makes something a kli rishon? What makes something a klisheni?" Right? We're going to say we don't paskin like the chavistas, or here might not even matter. But anyway, but the schilik, the chavistas wants to make chilik that it's dafka if it was on the fire. That's at least there got to be certain halachas that's going to be the kaveya. So the Mishabura didn't follow that rule. So the kaveya is it going to be, does it cool down? Is it going to stay hot for a long time? Then it's a kli rishon. If it's going to cool down quickly, then it's a kli sheni. So using that rule, this kli is going to stay hot longer than any kli rishon that you have in your house. It would stay hot for probably for 3 days. When they mix 500 gallons of hot water into the boiling water into this tank, this thing is going to stay hot for a week. So by that definition, we should say this is a kli rishon. Okay, just to show other rishonim that say this idea also, that the kaveya of the ambati is the size. The reason I mention this is because there's a discussion, is it because of the size of it, or is it because it's for rechitza? They all mentioned, since it's done for rechitza, you do it hotter. All the Rishonim use this expression, for rechitza is hotter. So what does it mean, for rechitza is hotter? Why, first of all, I don't know, personally, I would rather eat hot food than to cook myself in hot food. Why do I want my merchatz to be all that hot? If it's Yatz Lezba, I can't even enter into it. My hot soup or my hot tea, I like it to be Yatz Lezba. So I'm not sure why, so we'll see. Pasha says it doesn't mean I want to wash myself in such hot water. It refers to the size of the, let's see, it's referring to the size of the kli that I use for heating up this water. They would heat up a large amount of hot water, and then instead they'd pour cold water into it until they got the desired temperature that they were looking for. But since initially you would heat up 50 gallons of water, you know, some large amount, that would then have the din of an ambati, and we'd say that has the din of, even though I heat it up in kettles and I pour it in, It's a klisheni, but because I heated up 20 different kettles, I poured the water into my bathtub. My bathtub's a klisheni, but it retains the din of a kli rishon to it. If you look at the lashon of the Taisa Tzarash, he says avlambati chamin l'tach tzaynein. You can only pour an abati hot into cold. Okay, there the hainu klisheni. Abati isn't a klisheni. Dumya de kais. Okay, so he speaks it out. Many rishonim speak out. Abati is talking about that we're dealing with in the sugya is a klisheni, like a kais. Bidloi naka a mecham. And what's special about an ambatia is because it's made of merubim. It has a lot of water. The Piskei Arid also says the same. He brings Amr Nechemia, Allah Kushim and Minasia, Pirshaya Oisila Arid, Soinin, Imachamim Babatia, Shechayma Chazok. Can't mix cold with the hot water in ambatia. Okay, because its heat is intense. Okay, why is its heat intense? What's more intense about this heat? See the dafka b'kais mutter only into a cup. It's mutter. Avol mabati hakol aser bein chamol tarzoinin beitzelot tachamin. Sabri v'yisal member suffol reu kambati pirish. The dafka b'kais shu katan only by a cup because it's small. Bein chayim amruba. So its heat is not intense because it's a small amount of hot water. Mutter l'arav chamin. Avol suffol is gadol, but a suffol already is larger. Chayim amruba kambati. That's the din over there. Is suffol kambati or not? But anyway, but it's because it has it's larger, it's a larger amount of water, and therefore because halacha, okay, how we pass by suffol, whatever. But the ambati, everyone agrees, is you can't pour the cold water into the ambati, even though it's a klisheni, because it's a large amount of water. So this is what Rabelski always used to say, that our kalim today in the factories are they hold, you know, like I said, 500 gallons is not a guzma. That's, you know, that would be a normal factory. We have that type of a large kli, maybe some a little smaller, but 500 is definitely true. Definitely are those ones that size. Even 200 gallons would be, you know, these are, you know, very large kalim. They're not making up, you know, if you have a small mom and pop shop where they're doing, just a few gallons or something, yanachanami. According to a cliche, you have the regular rules of cliche. But if I cook things up in these large kettles, and then I transfer it into a cliche, then that remains a kli rishon on it as well. And really, what, if you think about it, what does that mean to transfer it? It's just an irui. All that takes place over there is I heat up kettles and I'm pouring into the ambati, or I'm pouring into the second thing. I'm doing irui, right? I'm doing, we'll call this over here an extended irui, in the sense that when I even though it's an irui, and then another irui, and then another irui, but it never cools down. It has no ability. It's keeping the thing hot, and it'll keep it hot for a very long amount of time. Now, exactly how long does it have to be? I don't know. You know, where exactly is the borderline between the length of time that something is hot, that's called the klisheni, and the length of time that something is hot, that's called the kli rishon? I mean, that's sort of the Gemara Shai level of suffol. Suffol kabati, suffol kakais. You know, where exactly do we draw the borderline? I don't know the size of a kais. I don't know the size of a suffol. I don't know the size of an ambati. But what we have today in the factories is larger than any ambati that the Chazal discussed. And certainly it has the din of a it would be included in this din of a bati, which is mufashal. So that would be a raya, and the same thing with the extended urui that I discussed before, where they end up pumping through a very, very large amount of water, maybe not 200 gallons, but they might end up pumping through 50 gallons when they do this for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, they're pumping through at high speed, a lot of water through these spray balls. You end up doing the same, even more so, because you don't even have any time for the water to cool down. As soon as the water would cool down, that water drains out and new boiling water is hitting the walls. So in a way, it's even more efficient and hotter than, you know, pouring, then filling it up, where you're allowing for some of the water to be cooling as new water is coming in. Here, it's constantly being heated. So again, I mean, there's many reasons why in a factory we allow this idea of extended irui. If it's heated by steam, certainly, or hot water, it's the whole kli was only heated to begin with through what we call an extended irui. Certainly, you could kasher it with an extended irui. But even the spray dryer, which I mentioned before, which is not heated by steam or hot water, it's not heated with irui. It's heated actually with fire. There's hot air that's blown in. Yeah, he said, again, whether the proper way to kasher that is with libun or hagala is a separate topic. But assuming the proper way to kasher it is with hagala, one, we would accept this as a Haggadah as well, because of the large amount of water that is constantly sprayed that doesn't allow it to cool down. The truth is, by that case of the spray dryer, they also do preheat the walls, but like I mentioned beforehand, it doesn't necessarily maintain such a high heat. They turn on the heat to begin with. You know, it's like turning on your preheating your oven to, let's say, 400, but then you had to make a whole bunch of adjustments on your oven before you can get the spray ball in place. It'll cool down considerably. But you know, there is some residual heat that remains, and hopefully that does help as well. Maybe that's the that's what I wanted to present.
Thank you. So can I just ask, how long, I mean, you said that you don't know how to be magdir, how long an extended Iroi is, but so what do you require in a factory?
Yeah, so we require a few things. There's a minimum of time. We say it has to be at least 20 minutes. Sometimes we say 30 minutes if it's a larger kli, but as always we say a minimum of 20 minutes. And there's another requirement that the water exiting the kli has to remain reislim. So, in other words, if you're spraying in, we define rice lim as above 190 or 195 degrees. So if they're spraying in, let's say, water that's 210, close to 212, let's say they bring up the boiling water, by the time they send it across to the pipes, let's say it's about 210 degrees when it's hitting the walls. And then what they'll typically do is, I mentioned it'll be a large amount of water, let's say it'll be 50 gallons of water, 100 gallons of water are going to get sprayed in. It's not 100 different gallons of water. What they do is they'll have their CIP tank, which they're going to be bringing to the boil. That CIP tank maybe holds 50 gallons, let's just say. Let's say it's a 50-gallon CIP tank. Maybe it's even a little smaller, but let's say it could be typical. It might be about 50 gallons. Then they're going to do is they're going to have that water cycle back. As it drains out of the kettle, it'll cycle back to the CIP tank, where it'll get reboiled, and then it'll go back around. And we look, so there are probes on these things, and we are looking to see that the temperature basically exiting the kettle is the same as the temperature entering, or at least it's above this 190, 195. So at that point, we could say if they've done 20 minutes when they start doing this, the water exiting is going to be very cold. You're hitting cold walls, draining down to the bottom, coming out the pipes. You're lucky if you're getting 120, 130. As you continue to do this, you're basically heating up the kli. You're making it into a, would be the same as a kli, any other kli that you could be mavashal with. And, if you were to, let's say, hang a piece of meat in the middle, in this kli or something against the wall, it would get fully cooked by the time you're done here. So, the requirement is it has to be at least 20 minutes, and it has to retain, we have to show that we aren't losing any temperature anymore. At that point, we see that the defanais are no longer makarais. The fanais are completely absorbed the heat, they're at equilibrium, and still it's being continuing to spray, and then at that point we consider it a galo.
Thank you. Can we ask questions now? Can I?
Yes,
yeah. Okay. So people pre-submitted questions. I think I'll just do all the asking, unless guys, just thought of something that they want to break in, then they'll just interrupt me, I guess. The first question someone submitted is why it is that the OU does not enforce a yashan status of products in Chutz La'aretz.
Well, to enforce, I can imagine what Rabelsky said about Chol Yisrael. Why doesn't the OU enforce Chol Yisrael? That gets, it's a question that people ask the OU all the time. He would say the OU is not only for for Borough Park and Williamsburg. The OU is for all of Chol Yisrael. If people want to be Chol Yisrael, the OU isn't forcing anybody otherwise. The OU doesn't tell companies what they can or cannot do. The OU is a certifying agency. If it meets the standards to be Chol Yisrael, the OU could certify as Chol Yisrael. If not. So the same thing with Yashin. If the food is if someone's makbid on Yashin, they should either look for items that are labeled Yashin, or they should follow guidebooks about what's considered the dates, and buy stock up or whatever it is. The OU, there are many people who pass them that like the Bach or like the Hoshokhan and the Ram and all the other Paiskin there, Mekel. And the OU, that's a policy in the OU, not to take whenever you have these types of machlokes, and the OU isn't the deciding, forcing Chol Yisrael what they should do. but rather they give the choices. Even comes to tuna fish, and you know, different opinions about it. Oh, you make special Bishul Yisrael tuna fish and regular tuna fish. You hold like this, fine. You buy this one, but that's why it's important that Rabbanim especially should be educated to know what the different standards of the OU are, what the different hidurim are, and let Baal Batim know what for your shul, what you think is the proper standard. The person thinks his shul only Chal Yisrael, so he should explain that if it says OUD, it's not Chal Yisrael. The OU doesn't. You have to look for things that say specifically Chal Yisrael on them. If you allow butter and not, so then you'd have to tell them. Okay, it says OUD, but you look at the ingredients, only butter, whatever your standards are. But though you can't make these decisions for people, what they should do.
Okay. Speaking of Chalav Yisrael, someone had asked that according to the OU, how does Rav Moshe's heter for Chalav Yisrael relate to other kinds of milk like goat milk, buffalo milk, elk milk, yak milk, and other similar products? Other than Chalav Yisrael, are there any kashrus concerns to be aware of when purchasing non-bovine milk?
Okay, I'm not an expert in these things. I don't know how much of these specialty milks the OU actually certifies. Goat milk, sheep milk, we do. There's goat milk cheeses and things that are made. I know we do certify those type elk, some of the other specialty animals, I don't remember, with buffalo, whatever they were. I don't know that the OU does them. Not that there necessarily is a problem with it. I think though the OU would want to see where they're made. Anytime you're dealing with something out of the ordinary, when it comes to cow milk, there's very standard ways of doing it. Cow farms are very large. They're very there's a standard process, and nobody's sitting there milking them by hand. There's automated machines. It's not worth anybody's time or effort to bring any other animals into the equation because it's. It doesn't stem with it with the equipment. It's not compatible. When it comes to animals that you start having to milk by hand, there probably are no equipment that are set up for milking elk or something. You probably have to know what you're doing, and so then I guess that would become more of a question. I don't know. I've never heard of any of these specialty milks being done except for the standard goat or sheep.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. Someone else asked, what's the halacha and relevant OU policy about packaged cut fruit without a hechsher, like in a supermarket somewhere?
Yeah, so in supermarkets, generally we say it's not a problem. The supermarkets cut a large amount of fruit. I understand some study above about the if it's a large amount, they have dedicated equipment. Even if the derech klal, these are not dvarim harifim, they're cutting up melons or watermelon or whatever. I don't know what types of fruits they're cutting. Even a pineapple has a little bit of harifus to it. It's not like a lemon, which is derech harif. Pineapple is not a derech harif. Just to talk for a second about Davar Charif, Lubelsky's definition general was that a Davar Charif means something that you have to eat slowly. You can't eat in a normal manner. So lemons, for instance, a person doesn't sit there chewing on lemons, eating them. You would use it, it's juice you put in, or you put a little bit of it, or you hang it on your tea or something. You squeeze it on your fish. But it's not something that you eat in a normal manner. A grapefruit, a pineapple, you eat normally. You eat them like you'd eat an orange. The Beis Hillel quoted in the Berehetiv in Simon Tadivov, he started talking about drinks, but he uses that definition. He says something that you could drink normally, like a normal drink, he says that's not a davar charif. If it's very chomutz, he's talking about like borscht and things like that. If you have to sip it, if you have, it's like we'd say schnapps, is a davar charif. You don't drink it like wine. Rebelskiel is not a davar charif. You drink wine, you drink a cup of wine like you would drink soda. Maybe I wouldn't drink two cups of it like I drink soda, but I would drink, a person could drink a cup of normal, makes kiddush, he drinks down a normal 4 or 5 ounces of wine, no problem. He doesn't have to stop in the middle, he doesn't have to, but yet a person who could do that for schnapps, he should get help. But it's the same thing for foods too. Again, there could be exceptions to this rule, But that's the general rule. Most of the foods that you can find cut up in fruits in the supermarket are not dvarim harifim. If it is a dvarim harif, then the Ramah brings that there's a minig lahachmer. But we assume, and anyways, it's just a minig, because generally we assume that it's not a problem because it's they have dedicated equipment. If a person were to go into a restaurant, though, and order cut-up fruit, there it is not recommended. That's because Schreier's on the line here. I don't know if he still is. He was. Anyway, he could tell you about the cut-up fruits in restaurants, but we've discussed it many times. But it's not like that at all. They can use the same knives. They could use the same cutting surfaces as they did. You know, everything is made to order right then. You know, it could be, if they ran out, whatever, they could be cutting off for you fruit right then. So depending on what you ordered, and one should not get in a cheaper restaurant to order cut up fruit. But in a supermarket, it's not a problem.
Right. Someone else asked, why does the OU report dairy equipment as regular dairy? If everyone knows a product is really dairy equipment like Oreos, and then one day it were to become real dairy, no one will ever know based on the Hechsher.
That's a good question. There's a few answers to the question. One is the OU actually is starting to include DE as a choice for companies. It is confusing DE, and I'll explain why. And I'll explain some of the limitations of DE, which the problem is not so many people are familiar with, and it's it is confusing. To label something DE, so there, as you know, there are different definitions of what's considered dairy equipment. Right? There's not Bernard Aliyadei Bishel, there's not Bernard Aliyadei Tzli. So then whenever the OU is going to start writing on its DE, we're already taking sides as to what's called real DE and what's not. What's really actually dairy, according to some shitas. The Oreo cookie is, they can make milk eggs on the cookies on the same lines. That's the concern, is that there are dairy cookies being made at the same factory. Not all them actually are. It depends on the specific plant or whatever, but there are definitely plants that are making Oreo cookies and are also making dairy cookies. And we have no guarantee that it's even Eina Ben Yaimai. It could be Ben Yaimai. And if it was listed as OUD, is that really dairy equipment only? Ask your local Orthodox rabbi, because as you know, the Shach is machmer like the Marshal, that's called Naparnat Aliyadei Tzli, and that's not really Naparnat. Others hold that the Ramah is Mekel, or Hashok is Mekel. You can count up heads over here, who's Mekel and Naparnat Aliyadei Tzli. It's not just Oreo cookies. I mean, it's really Negei. It's a lot of DE products. Your almond milk, for instance. So almond milk is really Naparnat Aliyadei Tzli. It's not Napa Aliyadei Bishel, even though it's Bishel, but we know the definition of Aliyadei Tzli and Bishel don't mean whether it's fried or roasted versus if it's baked, cooked. It means, was there Mayim separating between it and the other thing? So like a potato cooked in water is a Napa Aliyadei Bishel, because the Bliya went into the water and then from the water into the potato. But the water itself that was cooked in the pot is Napa Aliyadei Tzli. So this also, I mean, you know, I think for a long time the OU didn't like labeling things OUDE for these reasons. It's confusing what people hold and what is, you know, what you could do with DE is confusing. It's just dairy equipment. What does that mean? It means, is it only for Sfaradim? Is it for Ashkenazim? Is it, can I eat it together with meat? Do I have to wait till after? You know, so, you know, you can't eat it together at the same time as you're eating meat. People think it means I just can't cook it with meat, but I can eat it together. Whatever people in their mind think that DE means, a person's asking already, so then, the OU tells them this is the situation. There's no dairy in the product. This is, you know, now do with it as you want, so to speak. Once you start putting the DE on it, now the OU is taking sort of a chryas for telling people that this is what it is. But the truth is, this has slowly been changing over. There are more products that are out there. The OU has been doing this more for products that are, people want to make sure there's no dairy in them. You know, it could be confusing the other way. If I have an almond milk that says OUD, people get nervous. Oh, there's dairy in it, and then I I want to buy almond milk because I want to stay away from dairy, and now you're telling me that this almond milk is dairy. So, that also, you're not necessarily doing the consumer a service if you're confusing him the other way too. So therefore, things like that, the OU has been slowly, where they feel there's a need, they've been allowing it to be written as OUDE. In terms of the other question, whether the OU is it a michshol? Because if OU cookies would start getting putting dairy in there, people might still think it's dairy equipment. A company like Oreos, so it'll probably take them 5 years from when they make the decision to do so till it actually happens. Just the way these big corporations are. Whenever someone asks the OU, you'll get a response from the Weber Rebbe saying, check back in 6 months. And the OU writes that bedafka because of this concern. Of course, what happens is, chaver the chaver slay. Everybody now goes and tells their friends, OU cookies, there's no dairy, and you can eat it after fleishigs, or whatever the Torah Shabbal Peh becomes. It's very hard to control Torah Shabbal Peh. In a way, it would be better if they would write on them every time the OU holds it to be DE, they write DE. Companies don't necessarily want this either. It means they have to redo their packaging, or even they're going to get questions asked to them. What does this mean? People are used to this, seeing it says OUD. Their companies are happy with it. But these are all, all these different factors over here are all, they change every it's a moving target, so to speak. There's no rule of what, this is what the OU does as opposed to this. It's, for many years the OU did not do DE at all. That was opinion. That was a decision that we should not do any DE. Then at some point he decided it could be confusing the other way. So it becomes it's really a little bit. When we do it and when we don't do it is a little bit ambiguous at this point, but still, most cases, because the companies were happy to have OUD, they're not changing anything, and they're certainly not going to change anytime fast.
Right. Now, based on what you said about not only de tzli, are we to deduce from that checking allergy information would not be a good enough way to determine that it's DE?
Well, it depends. I mean, if a person's machbid on Napronali Deit Sli, then checking allergy information certainly is not good enough. You would probably have to figure it out based on what the product is. You have to look at it. If it's a cookie, it's going to be baked. If it's a drink, it's probably also going to be considered Ali Deit Sli. Most products today are going to be Ali Deit Sli. That's just the, right. The nature of how products are made today. Your sauces, your drinks, everything's cooked in the same kettle. As the, you could have a potato that was cooked in water that was cooked, but it's those products aren't being labeled OUD anyways. I don't know. You have to look product by product. But if someone's machmer like the shach,
then yeah. It would be difficult.
Yeah. Okay. There's not really no heter of OUD. Of dairy equipment.
Right. Also, someone else, how does the OU go about deciding whether or not to give a hechsher to a product, company, or restaurant which wants to be kosher and the food itself is kosher, but it may have other aspects that for some would be considered more hashkafically questionable or inappropriate, like sports bars, the name of a restaurant is inappropriate, or something like that?
Rabbi Schreier would be one of the people who would have to decide that, and then he would discuss it with Rabbi Ganek. And others who, appropriate people to discuss it with. I mean, this has come up many times. Oftentimes it depends what the politics of it. I don't mean this is negative politics, but sometimes, the OU is asked to give a special hashkacha to make an exception for various reasons. They don't want a different hashkacha coming in, whatever the rules are, whatever's going on over there and that, the OU does take into consideration these factors when giving hashkacha. If they consider the ambiance to be wrong, not appropriate, then they won't give hashkacha. Again, these are they're all case by case basis, so it's hard to say this is the rule. If it has this in it, then for sure not. It always depends on the what's going on.
Just another question. Maybe this is a thing of the past, but how did the OU handle when Rav Shachter and Rav Belsky disagreed? or even in general now, I guess, when different poskim just, I mean, I guess, I don't know who the OU poskim are other
Yeah.
than Rosh Hashanah.
Right. That's a good question. Rebelsky and Shachter, Baruch Hashem, you know, the way it worked out was there was a very good relationship between the two of them. They usually were able to come to a compromise, even when they disagreed. You know, I mean, I think it has to do with Shachter's nature of being, you know, very beganov. I'm sure those who know him, you know, he's you know. But anyway, but he works very well with other Paiskim. Now the OU works together with Rav Asher Weiss. Rav Shachter has an excellent rapport with Rav Asher Weiss as well. And, you know, oftentimes the machleksim come about because no one hears the other side of the conversation. If you have two, you know, people who are two Paiskim who are, you know, of clear mind, and you sit them down together to discuss something, usually by the time it's done, there was no disagreement really. It was more... I was concerned that XYZ would happen, and that's why I said no. And the other one said, no, I already realized why that would not happen. Or, you know, things like that. You know, it's the same Shulchan Aruch we all share. It's the same, you know, Paiskim. It's very rarely is it something where someone says, I have a Messiah that we have to pass like this Prima Godim, and someone says, no, I have a Messiah we go like the Chavos Das, you know, and clash. There's nothing you can do about it. It's not usually the case. Usually, you know, we look around to see what are the consensus of Paiskim are. And you know, if you have a reasonable paiskim, or you know, willing to you know to hear other people's opinions, you're going to get to reasonable conclusions. So that's Baruch Hashem. That's the way it was, and the way it still continues to be.
By tuna fish, how did it work out?
Well, the OU certifies tuna fish, and the OU also makes special bishuyim for tuna fish.
So Rebelsky is it true? Rebelsky was not in favor of certifying regular tuna fish.
Right, exactly. So Rogalski held that one should not eat the regular tuna fish, like the regular Starkist, you know, whatever it is, you know, these types of brands, except when they make a special Kashla Pesach run, or if it says BY on the thing. But yet, he didn't stop, you know, he didn't say, I'm leaving the OU unless you, you know, like we mentioned before, there are lots of foods like that where, you know, Rogalski didn't eat Kol Sam, but yet he was an advocate that the OU should certify Kol Sam. That he said, you know, that mentioned beforehand. At one of the Kashrus conferences, somebody got up and said, you know, it's just, sort of spoke strongly against the OU. He said, it's about time the OU, you know, raises things up a level and brings Kal Yisrael, you know, only Kal Yisrael. And it must be said, I'm sorry, you know, that we have to make kosher food available for everybody. It's not our job to, you know, If you make something only Chol Yisrael, yes, you know it's a higher standard. But yet, you've just you know we you can't get you know those you don't have a kosher store in your town. You can't get you know Chol Yisrael. You can't get these products. If you don't live in Borough Park, you're not going to be able to buy them. So you're not doing a Chol Yisrael a service. You have to still continue certifying the Chol Stam. Individuals should ask their rabbanim what they should do. You know, maybe today a person lives in a Jewish community. They have access to all this. A few pennies more, maybe they should pay for it. Maybe not. You know, it depends who you listen to on this side of the, you know, not in that debate on Kol Yisrael.
Right. Okay, we're coming close to 2:20. I don't want to keep you longer than I promised I would, but maybe one last question, and we'll leave the other ones, I guess, for a different time. I guess this is more of a general question. What are some common mistakes or misconceptions regarding kashrus that you think we need to be more alert about?
Common mistakes? I mean, there you know, people make common mistakes in terms of you know, the local establishments that are not certified. You know, I can go in here and get a cup of coffee, things like that. You know, that's you know, maybe yes, maybe not, depending on where they're going. You know, just because everyone else is doing something when it comes to kashrus. You know, doesn't make it doesn't mean it's that everyone's doing the right thing. You know, there's a lot to say about you know those types of. I don't want to get into that. It's definitely a you know, difficult conversation. I mean, the avid sometimes are you know. What other things? Common mistakes people make about kashrus. I mean, there are definitely different standards that people have. You know, like we mentioned beforehand. You know, person has to know what goes on in the kashrus. I don't want to bring up too much on this topic, but when it comes to Bishul Yisrael, for instance, many different kashrus agencies have different ways of dealing with it. Let's just say like that, things that need Bishul Yisrael. You know, a person, sometimes a person, you know, will ask his rabbanim if this is appropriate. Give an example, just one, you know, small example, you know, Eish Me'eish, relying on pilot lights in restaurants and things like that. You know, it's a very, very bad, you know, very, very, the Shasat Chaketer that is relied on too often, l'chatchilo. You know, is it appropriate to rely on these things? You know, if you knew personally what goes on and what they're relying on, it's important to be an educated consumer, you know, to know again, a lot of these things are very hard to know because the kashrus agencies don't necessarily reveal what they're doing, and you know, it's kosher. Don't ask so many questions. If you want to, you either trust us or you don't trust us. And then there's something to be said for that too. You know, I can't have everybody coming in and audit, you know, my restaurant or my, you know, my standards every day. Either you trust me, you don't trust me. But on the other hand, you know, a person should be aware also that there are all types of, comes to Bedikas Talayim, you know, also, you know, all different standards. It comes to a lot of these things. It's not, there's no black and white. There are many, many different, you know, grades of gray in between. It's important to be, you know, to at least be knowledgeable about what the issues are, what coolers different restaurants, you know, different places, different kashrus agencies are relying on, because, you know, you might say, you know, I learned through the sugya, that's very, very dachuk, that's very, a very big kula. You know, maybe we shouldn't be eating there, maybe I should help my people in my community, or maybe if I'm the rav of the community, I can raise the standards here and not have them continue with these, you know, with these kulas that are being going on. I don't know.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much, Rabbi Gersten. Thank you. This was really fantastic, and I appreciate it so much. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you, everybody. Okay, cool. Okay.